This is CliffCentral.com. Auto Central, powered by Auto Trader on CliffCentral.com.
Right, folks, good morning. Welcome to Auto Central, powered by Auto Trader, your trusted motoring marketplace. What a fantastic, fantastic weekend. Fazana, how was your weekend?
Oh, it was great, thanks.
Was it good? You're going to tell us a little bit about what you did a little bit later on in the show. And then we have an in-studio guest, Devin LaRue from Auction Evolution. Devin, how are you doing, man? Yeah, good, thank you. Hang on a sec here. You're not on there. Just check now.
Testing.
No. They're all on. There we go.
Testing.
There we go. Back. How are you, man?
Yeah, well, a new tire. And thanks, thanks for having me on, man.
Only,
I appreciate it.
It's only a pleasure. So, Devin's in studio. We're going to touch on the world of auctions a little bit later on in the show. But I think, as usual, we'll kick off with some news from the motor industry last week. And again, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all the social media channels at Auto Trader SA. So I see we're waiting for George. George is obviously stuck in a little bit of traffic. It's what happens when you drive a car to work.
George needs a bike.
Yeah, George needs a bike. We've spoken to him about this before as well. Fazan, I don't know if you know, but I see that the Ford Focus, you know, they had that issue with the head gasket and the engine block failures. Ford have confirmed a solution for all owners on the vehicles that have been affected. According to an article that is on our site at the moment that was compiled by Stuart Johnson, Ford have obviously come to the party and have said that any issues with these vehicles, they will fix. I mean, you got to think about it. You're shelling out just under 700K for a vehicle and you have massive engine problems. Can't be a nice thing for the users to have to deal with. So nice that Ford have come to the party and have said that they're going to sort that all out.
Very good.
Very good. Right. Next thing up, and this is a conversation that we can have because I'd like to get your guys' opinions on this, but do you guys think that speed cameras save lives? Oof. Fazana, I'll start with you.
I think it could, yes.
Do you think it could?
Yeah.
Devin?
If they placed more around, then people would really be aware of them and be, you know, controlling their speed and stuff.
So if you knew that all the speed cameras out there were actually working, people would actually respect the speed limits.
Yeah, definitely.
Because we're not clever enough to actually just go, okay, well, the law says you're not allowed to go faster than 120 on the highway, so let's just obey the law. Yeah. Devin, what is your take on speed cameras, man? What do you think?
Look, it's interesting, and yes, you don't play games, eh? Right into the most controversial subject, eh?
Exactly, straight in. You know, the thing is, I think a lot of people think that speed cameras is falls in one of two parts. It's either a money-making scheme or it actually is a preventative measure to kind of save lives. And there was a study that came out of Newcastle University where in the UK, over 800,000 drivers are caught speeding by camera each year. And obviously the minimal penalty is a £100 fine. And there's, you know, people that are sitting on a fence saying, you know, A, it's a money-making racket, or B, it actually does save lives. So they've gone in and they've done a whole bunch of testing and there's stats, but it actually, if you dig into it, it's a lot harder to predict an area that is, you know, obviously having a lot of accidents. So an area will have a lot of accidents. They'll, you know, implement a speeding camera, and then the assumption is that if the deaths or the fatality numbers come down, then that speed camera is working, but that's not necessarily the case all the time.
Tyron, I think just as dangerous as speeding, you know, is actually driving slow. They should start to regulate the guys that are driving at exceptionally slow speeds, because this is actually, for me, what causes accidents.
Well, I think that's the thing. It's respecting the lanes of the highway. 100%. You know that the left lane is the slower lane, and the lane on the right is the faster lane.
But enforce the minimum speed, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Truly. Yeah, I mean, I had incidents on this weekend. I mean, I saw two crazy things this weekend. One was a truck that was, you know, completely overloaded on the highway, which is always dangerous. And the second thing is I saw some clown driving a motorbike without a helmet on, and he was like just cruising down the road, and I was going, where do you actually, you know, who do you think you are that you can get onto a bike, even if you're going around the block, without a helmet? You have to wear a helmet when you ride a motorcycle.
That's wild.
So obviously these guys don't respect their own lives, do they? Hello, no. George.
How's it, Ty?
How you doing?
Sorry, I'm a bit late.
No, it's fine. Traffic out there?
No, I just had to do one or two things for my day job. Exactly. Before I got
well, it happens when you're the big boss of a big company. You know, sometimes your time's not your own, eh?
Yeah, and sometimes things take longer than you expect them to.
Exactly,
take,
so. 100%. Well, that's good. We were just touching base. I don't know if you know, but Ford have come to the party and said that anyone having issues with their RS, the engines, will be sorted out.
That's brilliant.
So high five to them. And then we've just been touching base on some speed camera theories. But really what I wanted to start the show off and kick off with was, we all know that we had Auto Circus powered by Auto Trader last week featuring the Gymkhana grid, which is Ken Block and all of his cronies out at Carnival City. And I can tell you now that that was one of the best motoring events that I have ever been to. It was, and I can say this, off the charts.
It was, I concur, it was one of the best motoring events that I've seen in South Africa. You know, I didn't go to any of the Formula One races when they were here. I was a bit too young. So I would have thought that that event was kind of, the hype was, you know, up there.
Yes, I definitely reckon. Really was great. And I think the weather gods were out there, because I mean the weather over the 2 days was absolutely fantastic. There was hardly any rain, which meant that the track was, you know, same conditions for all the drivers. The crowd turned out, the people were there, there was food, there was, I mean, everything that you needed at an event was it was there.
I was saying to Kerry yesterday, with the rain we've had this weekend, what if Gymkhana was on this weekend?
I can only imagine it would have been absolute carnage out there.
because it was raining all weekend.
Exactly, and we know that they built that track specifically for this event.
Yeah,
and I mean, you know, you were fortunate enough to be one of the lucky few that got to ride with the head Hoonigan himself, Mr. Ken Block.
I tell you what, some people have said to me that they don't talk to me anymore because I got to ride in the car with Ken Block.
I'm not
like
surprised. Is Jim one of those guys?
I don't want to talk to you anymore, you know.
I mean, just tell us. I mean, we were obviously there on the Thursday for the press launch, which is when you guys got to, you know, to have this experience. And I mean, we were all sitting waiting, watching for this car to hit the grid. And it was the first time he had been onto the grid in his vehicle. You were fortunate enough to be in the car with him. And we were sitting, and I cannot believe the off-the-line speed that car actually generates. I mean, just give us a little bit of insight as to what you experienced.
So you could probably equate it to it's like a roller coaster,
yeah.
but the end part, you
yes.
know, when that roller coaster comes to a screeching halt,
yeah,
it's the opposite of that. It's that launch into that track is unbelievable.
Absolutely.
And then the rest of the ride is like a roller coaster.
And I mean, you enjoy driving.
I love it.
You know, you've done a number of courses. You've obviously been on skid pans and stuff in your time before. The control that these drivers have over their vehicles, I mean.
So I was watching him in the car while I was sitting there, and you know, I'm not a scary cat. You know, I love adrenaline stuff. So for me it was exciting. It wasn't scary at all. And so I can fortunately kind of be calm in situations like that. And I think flying has taught me to be that way. But I'm sitting there watching him, and you know how you would drive with, you know, one hand turning the steering wheel, or one hand on the steering wheel on the highway. You know, supposed to have two hands on the steering wheel, but some people kind of drive that way, and especially if you're changing gears, you got one.
Yes.
He was driving that way. It wasn't like he was, you know, grasping the steering wheel and it was all, you know, muscle and force. And no, it was very relaxed.
So it's almost, I mean, you could equate it to dancing with a car. I mean, he is doing a dance with that vehicle. He knows every square inch of that thing.
It's not like he wasn't moving fast. I mean,
he was moving quickly. But, I mean, you only need to watch some of the videos that are on our site to see.
I mean, he was doing stuff with the handbrake and with the gears and with the steering wheel, but it was graceful, if that's the right word.
Absolutely.
It was absolutely graceful. Yeah. At no point did I feel like he was out of control of that car.
Yeah, I mean, for me, as a first time experiencing an event like this, well, and the format of the racing, you actually don't have to be a motorsport fanatic, because at the end of the day, it's a race. So whether you're watching a race between two dogs or two human beings or two motor vehicles, the thrill of the race is absolutely exciting. And when you see what these guys are doing, going around all their, like, you know, hitting their clipping points, which was a term that I learned on the weekend, it really, really is exciting to watch.
You know, the most exciting part about this kind of mirrored grid is the the anticipation you feel when those cars are so close.
Yes.
Because you don't feel that in a normal kind of circular track race.
No.
You don't feel that kind, you know, who's going to come out of this thing ahead, and it's literally 60 seconds and it's over.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, yeah, and phenomenal. I mean, we had all the international drivers out here. We had some local drivers out here. Well, not out here because they are out here. And the guys competed, and a lot of South African drivers got to experience this kind of international format for the first time. And speaking to some of the local drivers, they were just saying, what an absolutely amazing thing.
They all apparently learned a lot.
A hell of a lot.
You know, watching the rear-wheel drive and the four-wheel drive or the all-wheel drive cars, I don't know if Jim Carner, this is my personal opinion, I don't know if Jim Carner's made for the rear-wheel drive.
Okay.
You know, it was too slow. And the all-wheel drive is unbelievably quick.
Yeah. I don't know if you know, but one of the local drivers, and his name eludes me at the moment, but he had issues with his car apparently on the Friday afternoon.
Otto.
Was it Otto? Who borrowed his wife's Mercedes-Benz. And it was a stock standard, was an A-Class. Was it A-Class? Yeah, did you see that? That was his wife's car. He was like, listen, my car's, you know, lost the plot, so I'm taking yours for a drive this weekend. I mean, can you imagine, you know, driving around, you know, competing against the likes of Ken Block in your wife's Mercedes-Benz. But something that you know, we were all there for the thrill of the race, but just to unpack how exciting drifting actually is. Obviously, within the auto circus area, we had a lot of activations. There were motorbike stunts. We had our own. We had the drift cars that were drifting for the consumers that were there on the day. And I managed to kind of convince my 6-year-old that getting into the back of one of these drift cars would be a good thing. And he was a little bit apprehensive. He was like, "I don't know, Dad. I don't know." I was like, "Come on, man, just suck it up, you know, be a big boy." So we jumped into the car with friends of ours, and he sat in the back of the seat. We obviously strapped him up, and all he was saying to the driver, and this was just pure nerves, was, "Please don't drive fast. Please don't drive fast. Please don't drive fast." Anyway, we eventually had to say to him, "Listen, these guys only know how to drive one speed, and that is fast. So I'm going to play you a quick clip, and I want you to hear how this child went from being absolutely fearful to just
excitement
and joy." So you can hear how he went from, you know, from being so scared to just absolutely loving it. And I think that's the kind of experience that you get when you step out of your kind of comfort zone and go and try new things. Like I said, I've never been a motorsports person, but working for the brand that I work for, we get exposed to these kind of things. And it really, really is fantastic. There's spectator value for all shapes and forms. So, you know, hats off to Mike and Jim from XS Promotions, who I think put on a really, really great event. And talk is that it might be coming back next year. We're not quite sure what the story is, but I certainly hope it does come back.
Absolutely.
I really, really do. I hope it comes back.
I've been a car nut my whole life. I know more about cars than you think I do. But I'm very fortunate to be part of this brand and being able to experience that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Awesome.
The opportunities are fantastic. All right, so moving along into our next story. Uber, once again, I don't know if you guys know, but 57 million drivers and customers had their personal information stolen by hackers who obviously hacked into the back end of Uber's setup. And things like names, email addresses, and cell phone numbers were stolen, as well as 600,000 driver's license numbers. And this, again, is, I actually feel sorry for these guys, because they came up with an awesome concept to try and improve public transport. And they've just been, you know, mirrored with, you know, this like black cloud of rain that hangs over them all the time, and every now and then it just opens up a shower on the guys.
Yeah, you know, when you grow that fast as a business, it's very difficult to keep all of the loose ends tied up. It's very, very difficult to do. And it's a dilemma. You know, you grow fast, and some of the stuff you just can't keep hold of, or you don't grow fast and you got everything buttoned up, but then someone else beats you to the punch.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think, you know, Uber's suffering from its own, you know, its fate of growing as fast as it
has. Correct. But they've also had issues with some CEO issues. I know that Travis Kalanick, after an internal investigation, concluded that he had built a culture that allows female workers to be sexually harassed and to push the legal limits. He's been replaced now by Dara, and excuse me if I pronounce this wrong, Khosrow
Khosrow Shahi, I think it's how you pronounce it. And her, since she's taken over, she's obviously flagged that, you know, this matter wasn't handled properly, and that these people whose information was stolen, they should have been notified a lot sooner than what they were. I see that also in 2013, 2014, Yahoo had 300 billion bits of information stolen from users, and then they only told their people in 2016. I think security from a website point of view is really, really important. I mean, it's something that we take extremely important because we know that people have their personal information out there, you know?
It is extremely important. And, you know, that besides growing fast, I think that CEO had something to do with not tying up the loose ends. You know, good on them for having seen that, and they've got somebody else in place now.
To kind of fix it, yeah.
Hopefully they can kind of tackle the...
Well, I mean, they paid 100,000 rand bribe to the hackers to make the problem go away. So they obviously try to cover it up, which isn't a good thing. And I mean, we'll land any kind of CEO in the hot seat.
How do you pay a terrorist?
Exactly. You know, rather just deal with it through the correct channels, I would assume.
Exactly. I mean, I think there's ways to deal with that, and not, you know, because you're actually incentivizing the hackers to continue doing it. Yeah. Oh, okay, if we do this, somebody will pay
us. Yeah, we'll get some more money.
You know, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. Anyway, moving on to another story. So again, that's just, you know, what's happening with Uber at the moment. So just more problems. And I love Uber. I think their service is fantastic. But, you know, you've got to have your back end sorted out.
The concept is fantastic.
100%. So taxi operators are fuming over the auto amendment bill. And this statement actually shocked me, where minibus taxi operators in the Western Cape have promised all hell will break loose if a traffic bill that encourages the impounding of vehicles becomes law. And the long and short of this is the amendment to the bill is saying that they want stricter controls over vehicles that are using the roads, and cops should really have the right to impound vehicles if you're caught street racing, if your car is unworthy, if you have an unregistered vehicle, if you've got fake license plates, or if you're driving with no license. Now, that makes complete sense to me as a user. So... this Andile Kanyi, who is the secretary for the Congress for Democratic Taxi Association, I mean, it sounds like a political party with a name like that, is saying that they haven't been consulted and they want to be able to help and assist and make the laws. But this is just a taxi association. They're not even dealing with the body that oversees all the taxi associations. I don't think they have a right to say anything. The roads are for all users, and we should all abide by the same rules.
You know, laws are there for a reason. They're there to protect other people. You know, if you can drive an unroadworthy vehicle today,
yes,
you're not only putting yourself in danger, and it's not about you; it's about the other person you're putting in danger.
Well, exactly. So I don't know. Something just, the red light goes off in my head that these guys. You know, obviously there are taxis out there, and there's vehicles out there. It's not just taxis. It's not like everyone's...
Well, I don't think this is directed at the taxis.
No,
this
it's is completely
directed
not.
At the motoring industry.
100%. You know, but I think they're making it about themselves by saying that they don't have a hand in what's said. But I'm just going, you guys have to apply by the rules. Anyone who has a driver's license or drives a car on the roads in South Africa has to abide by the law. End of story.
Any car that's on the road,
100%,
absolutely. Okay. I don't see why any group or party should be exempt from driving roadworthy vehicles.
Exactly, and following the law. Couldn't agree with you more.
But Tyron, it all comes down to enforcing the law at the end of the day, doesn't it?
100%, Devin. It really does. That's we've had conversations on the show plenty times. I mean, when the Metro Police built a cardboard cutout of a vehicle, a police car, and stuck it under a bridge, and they said that was going to, you know, curb problem. But only visible policing and enforced policing by the metro, by the traffic department, is going to help curb the issues that we have on our roads.
That's it.
I mean, Cape Town leads the charge
completely.
And hats off to them because you can get your cell phone taken away from you and put into a locked box in Cape Town if you're talking on
the phone.
Absolutely, take it away from you. You can come and fetch it and pay a fine at the police station, which is a huge inconvenience, and it will teach you not to talk on your phone in the car.
Absolutely, hands-free kits. You know, plug headphones in if you have to. Just don't hold your phone when you're driving.
I've had a few friends that have been caught that way, and you know what? You don't get any sympathy from me. I fully support that.
Exactly.
Fully support.
Absolutely. So anyway, so that's the news out of the industry from the last 2 weeks, were the big stories that were making the news. And once again, there was an exciting race that happened yesterday. George, did you watch a Grand Prix?
Of course I did.
There we go. Stupid question.
Well, yeah, it was an exciting race. I mean, I think the guys were not racing that race purely just for the race and the points. I think they were racing that race to collect data for next year.
Okay.
Because,
well, our season's kind of won already. It's wrapped up, so it's wrapped a dead rubber.
I mean, the only way that that Vettel wasn't going to come second was if he came ninth or lower. And the only way that was going to happen was if he was going to crash out. So he kind of just went through the motions. But I think the biggest thing was Bottas. Bottas was on pole position. He didn't want to lose to Hamilton. Hamilton obviously wanted to win the final race because he's now the champion for the year. He tried to give him a go for a couple of laps, and it just didn't pan out, which I think is good because it kind of, it'll keep Hamilton a little bit humble.
Yeah.
You know, and realizing that his teammate can be as fast as him.
He is, yeah.
And it's not as easy to pass if you're not in the front.
Yeah.
Because Hamilton's used to being in the front.
You're an avid follower of F1. I know back in the day there was you had your primary driver, and then there was a second driver. Do you think that's changing a lot, where both drivers are equally as important, or do you think there's always a favorite?
No, I think in most instances there's a favorite, especially in the top teams, unless the second driver can challenge the primary driver. That's why Vettel's made it very clear he'll only stay with Ferrari if Ferrari doesn't hire Verstappen.
Okay.
Because obviously Verstappen's going to give him a run for his money and put his world championship prospects at risk.
Yeah.
So I think the teams do see the drivers equally if they're equally matched.
Okay.
You know, right now, Kimi Raikkonen, unfortunately, is nowhere near the level that Sebastian Vettel's at. And he signed up for another year, which makes Vettel happy.
Correct.
It doesn't make the Constructors' Championship very good, because you've got, you know, one substandard driver and one world championship driver.
Yeah.
So for me, I don't think there should be team orders, but I think there are team orders if you've got a really strong driver.
Yes, exactly.
And I think Bottas is challenging that team order in Mercedes, because he's showing that he can be as good as Hamilton.
Yeah. So they're obviously giving him, you know, as much attention, which is fantastic. Which I think it should be like that. You know, both racehorses should be able to run the same race.
Exactly. I think that's right. But usually what happens is they start off on an even playing field in the beginning of the year. And then as the year progresses, so one driver surfaces. Yeah. Usually it's Vettel or Hamilton. And then they start getting preference.
Okay.
And that's
the F1 season now wrapped up. We're done and dusted.
Middle of March is 2018. Yeah. And apparently they're talking about changing the engines for 2021, so they're pushing hard to go back to V8s, with not as much hybrid power, and to bring back the noise.
I did hear a bit of that on the pit walks and stuff. Some of the interviews that were happening yesterday. So, I mean, what is your take on that? Do you think that's going to be better for the sport?
So, I mean, you know, I think general commuting and motoring will go electric.
Yep.
And I mean, that
and motorsport
ship is
should
kind
stay
of,
motorsport.
And motorsport should stay motorsport. And you know, I think it'll take the excitement out of motorsport if we had electric motor vehicles racing around the track. It'll be silent. It'll be
fast and silent.
Fast and silent.
Yeah. So anyway, and then overall, I mean, your take on the 2017, what's it, 2016, no, 2017 season? Good season?
I think it turned out the way it should have been. You know, I think Vettel could have won this championship.
Okay.
If he had controlled his emotions a little bit.
Yeah. So do you think when because him and Hamilton had that little dust up, didn't they?
Yeah,
they
had two or three dust ups in that one big one. And I think that threw him a little bit. My two cents worth is get some coaching, get some emotional intelligence, and then he'll win.
Focus on the race and not on your opposition.
Exactly.
He's got everything that he needs.
He's talented. He's got the right car. He's got everything in the bag. He just needs to take control of his emotions.
Absolutely. Well, that's the Formula One season, and we'll obviously pick that up again next year, as we do. But right now, like I introduced early on, is Devin LaRue from Auction. Sorry, Devin. Auction Evolution. That's it. It's on your shirt. I don't know why I just didn't read it there. And Devin's here to really unpack a subject for us that I don't know too much about, which is why we got him in studio, because I think it's something that's really, really interesting. And Devin, you're in the auction game. You have an auction business. Yes. We chatted outside of the studio in terms of, you know, where you've come from. But just give us a little bit of a background as to who you are, how long you've been in the industry, and then we can get into some of the questions.
Question I have is, can Devin talk really fast?
I myself am not an auctioneer.
Okay.
I own an auction company, but no, unfortunately not. Okay. You know,
it fascinates me how fast those guys
can talk. It's true, you know, especially the international guys. You know, the South African market is very different.
Really?
They like the guys to be a bit slower.
Okay.
They like to hear the numbers quite effectively. But no, internationally, from America in particular, they have all those competitions. And
yeah, exactly.
You know?
Do those guys speak a different language, or is it English that they're just speaking really,
fillers.
Really quickly?
There's okay, fillers really at the end of the day.
Okay.
Look, I've been in the industry for almost a decade now. I've been very fortunate. I started off at Park Village Auctions.
Okay.
From Park Village Auctions, I went into the auctioneer in iBidder. That was the online auctions.
Yeah.
From there, I joined Nuka Auctioneers, Orca Auctioneers, and then, of course, we opened up our own company. So
okay.
I've been through the school of learning at the end of the day.
Fantastic.
You know?
So you cut your teeth being in the industry,
yes.
Which is why we got you
it's
in here as an expert.
Learn,
so I think, you know what? I want to understand an auction. What is an auction? Give us a basic overview about, you know, what they are.
Yeah, look, I think I'd like to start by saying that it's nothing new. You know, auctions have actually been around for centuries, but I think the natural curiosity in the marketplace is now peaked. You know, I think from everyone's concerted marketing efforts, you know, I think that we are now breaking into the end user market in quite a strong way. But generally, I think an auction is a big public sale,
okay.
You know, where you attract a multitude of buyers, you know, a couple hundred buyers onto your shop floor. You've got 150, 120 cars, maybe 200 cars, trucks. I specialize in trucks in particular. And you know what? I think the nice way to look at it, and my personal way of looking at it, I like to think differently, you know, is that it's effectively a tender process. You know, every bid effectively is a tender, if you will, you
yeah.
know. And, you know, I've heard the loose term thrown around for fair value, you know. I think at the end of the day, you're talking about true value, you know. You bring a multitude of bidders onto the floor and you let the market actually determine. You know, the price at the end of the day. I think that's what we call a free and fair process, you know. There's no price fixing around it. There's no collusion. There's nothing of the sort. So for me, it's the best way to come to a true value. And for me, it's a sliding scale. It's the price at which the buyer is willing to pay and the price at which the seller is willing to sell.
Yeah.
And there it lies in the middle, true value, true market value.
Well, I suppose it's willing buyer, willing seller.
Absolutely.
You know, and nobody can argue with the price between willing buyer, willing seller.
100%.
And if you aggregate all of those averages in the day, then you've got a true price.
Exactly.
That's it.
You know, nobody can say that they're overpaid, and nobody can say that they...
Yeah, because at the end of the day, you're making a decision about how much money you're willing to let out of your pocket.
Exactly.
And the other person on the receiving end is, well, that's enough money. So we agree and we move forward.
Yeah.
Happy days.
Yeah.
Devin, tell me, are there different kinds of auctions? What kind of auctions do we have out there in the market?
If you can sell it.
Yes.
If it's for sale, you can auction it.
Okay.
At the end of the day, really, you've got property auctions, you've got car auctions, you've got warehouse, art, truck auctions, earth moving, mining auctions. You've got private auctions, public auctions. Of course, we sell by way of public auction. You have reserved auctions, unreserved auctions. You've even got reverse auctions, which we really don't need to get into now.
It's only an hour show. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But I think in particular, I'd like to concentrate on reserved auctions and unreserved auctions.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
I think that's important. You know, we ourselves run with reserved auctions. A reserved auction is, of course, a price at which you're going to sell it. That's generally, you know, you talk of market value, you talk of true value. You actually talk of forced value. It's a distressed sale. It's come from the corporates. It's an end of contract. It might be a defleet. It might be bank stock, you know, in particular. And it comes out at a forced value, if you will, which generally can be calculated about, I would say, 30 to 40% off of retail. You know, a general rule of thumb for me is 30 to 40%, but you're looking at about 80% of trade.
100%.
You know, generally
okay.
speaking.
Yeah.
That's
but,
right.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that everybody should run out there and go to an auction, because I think there's steps and processes that one needs to
absolutely
to you know to
very good
to do before your due diligence, before you actually visit an auction. Let's take a step back. I want to go to an auction. Obviously you've got to sign up, there's paperwork that's involved, and that obviously then, you know, kind of what credits me to be able to raise my hand and, you know.
Yes. Look, the auction industry now, you know, I think before it was a loose business.
Yeah.
It has been tightened up somewhat.
Okay.
You have regulating bodies like SIA now, the South African Institute of Auctioneers, which is the governing body. Okay. Everyone falls under that. And we actually are... We are in full compliance of the CPA, okay. Section 45 of the CPA. So very importantly, absolutely, do your homework. FICA is an important thing. Mm-hmm. Before, you need to get your FICA in the same way that you would FICA your RICA, your cell phone.
Yeah.
We need a copy of your ID or your CFK documents if you're buying in the capacity of a company.
Okay.
You know, a copy of your or proof of residence at the end of the day. Then you come in. Look, we charge a deposit naturally because we open up the market. The market comes in their droves. And, of course, we must protect our sellers, the corporates, if you will. And so we charge a deposit. I myself charge a 15,000 Rand deposit. This is, of course, because we're selling high equity trucks.
Yeah.
Cars, I think the general rule of thumb is about 5,000 Rand for a car auction. And I think it's important, you know, at the end of the day.
Is that a refundable deposit?
Absolutely, okay, 100% refundable. Right. Look, if you don't buy 100%, it's within your bank account or back in your bank account within, I think, 24 to 48 hours, more likely 48 hours. But guys, I think very importantly, the deposit is there for a reason, okay? Mm. And you must remember that a bid is binding and contractual, okay? Mm. You've filled out the registration, you've signed the registration, the terms and conditions. And so I just must emphasize, you know, in our last auction, we actually had one or two defaults, okay? And when that happens, we will absorb your deposit, okay? That becomes forfeit at the end of the day. So please, it's just so important that the guys know that the deposit is there for a reason. And then it goes on to your next point, Tyron, you know, about doing your homework in particular, you know. When you go to auction, there is a viewing day. All right. There's more often than not more than one viewing day, sometimes 2-3 days. Okay. And we really need to emphasize that we want to be transparent. You know, we want the market to come through on the day of viewing, the day before the auction, generally speaking, come through and take a look at the cars. Okay. You know, do you know what? We even like to go one step further. I like to go one step further. You know, I'm not even well versed. I'm not a mechanic myself. Okay. So if I'm going to buy a car in auction, I might not know what I'm looking at. You know, so I really recommend to the guys, bring in a mechanic. Mm. You know, there's a couple entities, corporates that you can go in and list now. There's DECRA, there's the AA, there's a company called VVS, Vehicle Verification Services.
Yeah.
They can come in and they'll write out a 15-page report. They will go through that car with a fine tooth comb, you know.
Yeah.
And just know what you're buying. You know, I think this is the most important thing, to inform yourself, educate yourself, know what you're buying. I can't emphasize this enough. The auctioneer, myself, I don't want to fight with you after the auction. That is the last thing in the world. We want to play transparent and open, and you know what's more than that? We want sustainable business. We'd like you to come back a year or 2 years later, you know.
Yeah.
If you're buying and selling, we'd like you to come back regularly, you know. This is just so important. So please, guys, you must come to the viewing, check out the cars, go over it. I mean, I would even go that two steps further and say that if you didn't come to the viewing, if you didn't check out the car or the truck or whatever it is.
Yeah, then rather don't.
Rather don't bid. Can you believe it? Well, I'm actually saying to you, rather don't bid on the truck or the car.
Yeah, but I mean, I suppose that's like finding any vehicle out there that you see, you know, online. Let's say on autotrader.co.za, and you don't do your homework. You just send the cash over and buy. Yeah. You wouldn't do that anyway, would you?
No, I mean, I think it's very important to buyer beware.
Yes.
You've got to look at what you're buying, and if you want to make that decision, fine. But then you've got to take the risks that come with it, and those risks could sometimes be you haven't noticed something on that vehicle because you've got to be frank with yourself. The auctioneers aren't mechanically checking that car.
Yeah.
They're not, you know, they're getting that car in.
Correct.
They've got a platform that they sell it to the buyers from, and it's up to the buyer to check that that what they're buying is fit for purpose and can be used.
Which
you know, because at the end of the day, if you find something that's flawed on the truck or the car, just put the bid down.
Correct.
You know,
exactly.
That's your option.
Yeah.
That's your right.
Yeah.
Just put the bid down, and the auctioneer's not gonna look down on you for it.
For sure.
No.
Devin, a word that obviously gets used quite a bit in your universe is footstewards.
Yes.
Do you want to unpack that for us? So you know, and the question that I asked you was, can I return a vehicle if it falls apart after I've purchased it?
Look, we are governed by the CPA, and I think I would recommend everyone to go and read through Section 45 of the CPA. Footstewards is still a real thing.
Mm.
Okay. If you buy it, it's yours. You know, it's that simple.
Sure.
To be honest, the way that Auction Evolution likes to operate is that we will endeavor to assist you,
yes.
you know, with if something went wrong. You know, this is our thing. We've got personal relationships with every single one of our buyers at the end of the day. And this is really the crux of our business.
Yeah.
Okay. But out there, you know, it is contractual. It is binding.
Yeah.
You did buy it, you know. And
yes.
so it just goes back to your previous point.
Yeah, how much homework did you
Please
do on
Please go
the
and do the homework
exactly.
on the car. You know,
100%.
Look, you're getting it at, as I say, true value.
Yeah.
You know, if there was something, you know, I think auctions have notoriously, for the last couple of decades, have been a platform to buy and sell.
Yes.
Okay. The dealers will go onto the auction platform. They will buy and they will sell. They will buy directly from the bank on a bank auction or whatever the case is. They will fix it up. They have the capacity. They have the setup.
Yes.
To go and fix that. You
Correct.
See. But they are still saving on that car up to 40% to 50%.
Mm.
You know, as literal as that.
Mm.
So they are actually able to invest money into getting that into a runner or whatever the case is. These are actually two other terms that you must look out for: runner and non-runner. If it is specified as a non-runner, guys, that means it doesn't turn over.
Yes.
It doesn't start.
Yeah.
If it's a runner, it turns over. You can listen to the engine. It will drive.
Yeah.
It's that simple.
Okay.
So please be aware of those two terminologies. But that's really what it is, you know. I think what's happened here is, with, as I said in the very beginning, everyone's concerted marketing efforts, you know. Auto Trader has been helping us with the marketing, and we've been advertising with you guys as well. So what's happened is we're cracking open the end user market.
Yeah.
And they're realizing that, you know what, if you come onto auction, I can save a lot of money, you know, really at the end of the day. And actually, it's like we were speaking, Tyron, outside, you know. The low equity cars on 100,000 Rand, if you had about 30%, and please don't hold me to 30%.
No, exactly.
If it's a high value vehicle, the market is going to bid on that.
Yes.
I've seen instances, guys, where it's called bidder's euphoria.
Yeah.
Where the guys actually bid well over retail because it was supply and demand.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's really what happens at that point in time. That's why that car went.
Yeah.
Maybe it was a VW and it was a Golf 7, you know, a DSG or something to that effect. You know? The guys are inevitably, the market is a lot stronger. The pool there would be 1,000 guys as opposed to, let's say, a Renault, where the pool is
it's
a little bit smaller.
Yeah.
So, of course, the bidding is going to, you know, just scale up and scale up and scale up. Yeah. Yes, Darren, yeah.
No, that's fantastic. I mean, it really sounds it sounds like an exciting industry.
Yeah.
You clearly, I can see that you're passionate about
what
you do. And yeah, Devin, I think thanks very much for popping in here today and shedding a bit of light on a subject that I'm not too well versed in. And
Good.
And I can tell you now that I've certainly taken quite a bit out of what you've had to say, and I might have to come and watch one of these because I've always wanted to say,
you
bought it.
Awesome. You know what? In closing, I mean, this is perfect, man. You're exactly right. Look, guys, remember that it's a public auction, okay? So it's open to the public. You know, as I said in the very beginning, everyone has a natural curiosity when it comes to auctions. I think it's very important. Tyron, come through. Come to my next auction.
I will do.
My next auction is on the 16th of January.
Okay.
Okay. Come through, check it out, experience it for yourself.
Yeah.
Watch what happens. Watch how it goes.
Yeah.
Look at the people that are bidding. Look at the auctioneer. Speak to the auctioneer. Come and experience it for yourself. You know, we've got a lot of guys that come to the auction that come to document prices.
Mm.
You know, this is awesome. Come and do that, you know.
Exactly.
Come and see what the market-related prices are, the true values of the prices are.
I'll definitely do
Come
that.
And take a look. Thank
Fantastic,
you,
Fantastic, Devin. Thanks very much for joining us on the show. As we usually do, Chad, I know, got behind the wheel of the VW Golf GTD, and he has lined up a review for us. So I'm going to hand over to Chad.
Eater Comfort Line offers you 81 kilowatts and 250 newton meters. And that's where the Golf GTD comes in. It's when you want a little bit more from, well, a diesel offering, something that's still going to return respectable fuel consumption figures, have all the nice trimmings of the GTI, but be running a diesel motor. As such, the GTD is powered by a 2-litre four-cylinder turbo diesel, and it makes, get this, 130 kilowatts. That's right, 130 kilowatts, that's over the 81 kilowatts of the normal 2-litre TDI. 130 kilowatts and 350 newton metres, that's 100 newton metres more than the 2-litre TDI Comfort Line. However, it is still a far cry from the GTI, its petrol sibling. Because the new Golf 7 GTI makes 169 kilowatts and 350 newton meters. So the newton meters are pretty much the same, and I get a sneaky suspicion that the newton meters of the GTD could be considerably higher, but because of the gearbox and the DSG setup, they're having to limit that torque output. So 130 kilowatts and 350 newton meters from a turbo diesel, really nothing to be sneezed at. The rest of the package, and I'm going to come back to the motor in a little while in my driving impressions, but the rest of the package is, well, pretty much Golf GTI. So you're getting the same upgraded trim spec level inside. The material and the finishes are of a very, very high quality. You've got that fantastic infotainment system, and of course you can spec it with a full digital display in the cluster. Now, the infotainment is motion controlled for, well, skipping through tracks or skipping through stations, but it doesn't quite have volume control just yet like some of the BMW gesture control offerings. Now, that's not the end of the world, that's not a bad thing. It is still a very, very nice system. It works really well, it's pretty intuitive, and you've got all the mod cons and bells and whistles that you'd expect from a high-end VW Golf product. Now, I'm going to get back to the motor because it is about the drive here. So we've assessed that it is very much like a Golf GTI in terms of its trimmings. Heck, even the appearances look very similar. Sure, it's got slightly different wheels and it doesn't quite have that red line in front, going with rather a bit of a silver line in front and silver detailing in the headlights, but it's still a very tidy package. It looks racy, it looks purposeful. So GTD, the GT bits of things and the racy appearance, that comes across, but it's that motor. Now, 130 kilowatts isn't bad power, not at all. 350 newton meters, not bad at all. But the question that I kept on asking is, where is it making this power? Because it seems to be making it in a very, very narrow torque band. And this is something that is a downfall of diesel motors, is a very narrow torque band. And that's now where the real power and the real magic starts happening. With the Golf GTI, the petrol offering, that torque band is nice and broad, but that's inherent of petrol engines. With diesel motors, that torque band is considerably smaller, and it means that you need to quickly change through the gears in order to keep it on song. With the Golf GTD, I really found that to come to the forefront with this improved and increase in power. It really was a, dare I call it, a tricky car to drive. It felt as if there wasn't much underneath the foot, and it really needed to gather a little bit of momentum before it would get going. Either that, or you just have to plant it straight out of the blocks, but then it's all traction control, and that is the full 350 newton meters are churned out at very, very low RPMs. In fact, that newton meters comes in as low as 1,500 RPM, and it holds it all the way to 3,500. Now, the Golf GTI is also going to come in and start at about 1,500 RPM, but it's going to hold it a lot longer to 4,600 RPM. So there's that broader torque band that I'm talking about. And it just made the GTD a little bit docile, dare we say it, in traffic and daily driving. It really needed a lot of throttle input to get it going and moving and on the go, and quite a bit of hesitation when you put your foot down as it kicks down two gears or so, finds the right gear for you, and then lurches away and then quickly changes up again because of that narrow torque band. The power delivery is also in a very, very small RPM band. Now, that's between 3,600 RPM and 4,000 RPM, so it's really only peaking in 400 RPM. And that's a very, very small little peak to work with. In comparison, the Golf GTI goes from 4,700 RPM to the wrong side of 6,200 RPM. That's a broad band, and that can be felt. So it's not necessarily about the numbers, it's the way that it delivers the power. And that was the weakest point of the Golf GTD for me. It is still a great package. It's well-trimmed, it's practical, it's relatively quiet. It's not as quiet as the GTI, but it's relatively quiet. There's still a little bit of diesel clatter. It's not the end of the world, though. I just really couldn't get over that lack in the power delivery. And it delivered it, and then you were expecting some more, and then it was changing gear. Now, the DSG gearbox also isn't too bad, but once again, if you think that you're going to get around this small torque band problem by switching over to the steering mounted shifters and selecting gears yourself, well, then sadly you're mistaken, because selecting gears is just going to see you hop two gears, because as soon as it gets closer to the red line or that far end of the power band, you're going to select another gear, and the gearbox is also going to select another gear. And as a result, you're going to end up going, instead of from second to third, you're going to go from second to fourth. Now, this is an inherent DSG problem. They don't give you complete control. And it really comes to the forefront when you're trying to drive the GTD in the way that the name suggests. GT, spirited, performance orientated. I do not feel that this car is worth the GTD moniker. I don't believe that it deserves that badge on the back. Rather just give it a 2-liter TDI with a nice red eye or something of the sorts, but don't call it a GTD. I don't feel it deserves the same sort of accolades and the same sort of praise that the Golf GTI, the petrol version, gets. It doesn't deserve it. This, for me, it's a non-alcoholic beer. It really is. It looks the same, smells the same, tastes the same, but it just doesn't have the same effect. And then, of course, you're forking over a whole lot more money. So let's take a walk of what your options are here. Golf GTI, 546,000 Rand. Okay, just over half a million Rand there, close to 550. A 2-liter TDI Comfort Line, 386,000 Rand. Now, this is, of course, before you've tackled a couple of the options on the options list. The Golf GTD falls in between those, but it errs on the side of the GTI, coming in at 509,000 Rand, which is a heck of a lot of money for what is not that much more performance. You're pretty much paying for the trimmings. It handles well, it brakes well, it's got all the trimmings, but it just doesn't go like a car that has a GT badge on it. So I'm sorry, Volkswagen, you've missed the plot there. If this is the sort of thing that really tickles your fancy, I am going to suggest that you go out and you go and buy one now. Because if you don't buy one now, I'm pretty sure that VW is going to pull it from the range ever so quietly, not make any announcements, because I can't see many of these selling. Personally, I'd spend that little bit extra and go for the GTI. In terms of fuel consumption, well, there's not that much saving. They say that the average fuel consumption is going to be 5 litres per 100, and in the real world it was hovering around high 6s and 7s. But you drive a Golf GTI nicely, and you can get pretty close to that, maybe 1 kilometre or 1 litre per 100 out from that number. So for me, I'd rather just save up a little bit longer and go for the GTI. Hope you guys enjoyed the review. Back to you in the studio, Ty.
Well, thank you, Chad. Lovely review there, and getting Chad's opinion on the VW Golf GTD. Sounded like he has obviously some, you know, concerns with the vehicle, but we'll see how that all pans out. It's crazy. You know, sometimes these cars actually do far better than what's expected. So
yeah, but they're going to stop making diesels now.
I think so too, and you'll see now. I mean, we're about to get into our tech segment, and we all know the reason why you've had to just, you know, what you've said, George. And right, so talking tech, and once again, we know that Mr. Musk has been up to quite a bit, it would seem, and he unveiled on Thursday last week the first electric semi truck, and surprise, surprise, a new sports car. So Musk reckons that driving a gas sports car would be like it would feel like a steam engine with a side of quiche. Elon Musk obviously pitched the electric truck to truck drivers at the launch last week. But what I really like about this guy is he really knows how to hype stuff up. I think he's either got a really, really solid marketing department behind him, or he is just naturally, he's got the gift of the gab. Because what he did prior to them unveiling the truck, he was obviously all over Twitter, and he was going out with tweets like, it will blow your mind clear out of your skull and into an alternate dimension. And then on Wednesday, he was saying that, this is obviously before the launch on the Thursday, that it can transform into a robot, it can fight aliens, and it can make one hell of a latte. Now, those are things that you don't expect from trucks, but you know, Tesla obviously out there pushing the boundary. And I think this is fantastic news, because what they're saying is that this truck will run at 20% less per mile. Now, I think if you're in the transport industry, that's quite a considerable saving.
I think the the biggest draw card for this truck is obviously its efficiency.
Correct.
But just to put in perspective, you know, the power of an electric truck versus a diesel powered truck.
Yes.
0 to 100 in 5 seconds.
Yeah.
Or thereabouts.
Yes.
0 to 100 in 5 seconds. I mean, where do you see a truck doing 0 to 100 in 5 seconds?
No, you don't. Well, yeah. I mean, you know, you're touching on that, George. I mean, you also went on to say that these are some of the positives that this truck will have. It's going to be, it's going to have faster acceleration, which obviously touches on your point.
Well, faster acceleration kind of just means more power.
Correct.
More
exactly.
power per kilogram or per ton of load.
Yeah. So better uphill performance. I mean, we all know that anyone who's driven back from Durban driving up Van Rennen's Pass, if you get stuck behind two trucks, it really can be... You know, add an extra half an hour onto your trip.
Sometimes those trucks up Van Rennen's, they stop because they just can't carry the load up that hill pass.
Yeah, so it's a better uphill performance. 500 miles, so 805 kilometers at maximum weight and at highway speed. That's what they're saying the range of this truck can be.
Which is, in a lot of instances, more than a diesel truck can do.
Probably, yeah, exactly, because I mean, you know, we know how the garage is the situation on those routes, and that's because these trucks are filling up more than once or twice, aren't they?
Exactly.
So, and then something that I don't know, maybe we can touch on here. It's got thermonuclear explosion-proof glass. Any idea why it would need that?
Thermonuclear explosion.
I'm assuming from the back.
No, so I think a lot of these trucks carry hazardous materials.
Okay.
And the hazardous materials, you know, you've seen on Van Rennen's Pass when a truck has an accident and it's a tank, fuel tanker, what kind of devastation it can cause.
Yeah.
So anything that can stop the fumes or flames from getting into the truck and get the driver out of the truck. What's interesting about this truck as well is that it has a center-mounted cabin. So the driver doesn't sit on the left or the right as with your traditional truck. He sits in the middle. It's absolutely kind of phenomenal the way they've subtly changed how the features inside the truck are.
But I think that's what Musk does. He really does. When they work on a project, they kind of try and look at it from every aspect. And if they have to reinvent something, they will do that.
Well, it's just, you know, he said himself a number of times, it's thinking about things from first principles. We often, as human beings, we come at things from a perspective of what everyone else has done.
Correct.
Okay, it won't work because, you know, this is the way it's always been done. He doesn't come at things from that perspective. He doesn't come at things from a perspective of, this is how it's been done in the past. Yeah. He doesn't do that. And I think that's why you see these fresh kind of subtle things come through, especially in this truck. I mean, center-mounted driver seat. Another thing about this truck is it has autonomous driving.
Yes.
In the future it's going to be full autonomous where, you know, the truck will drive by itself no matter where the driver is. But in this particular instance, the truck can know whether you're asleep. So, and if you are, it'll pull to the side and it'll stop.
Jeez, luck.
So you
probably
know,
sing your lullaby at the same time.
Sing your lullaby, do whatever you want, which is phenomenal. Because how many times have you heard about truck
Correct.
Drivers being pushed by the company that they work for to do double shifts?
Yeah. And we know it's a long hauler. It's not like driving a car to Durbs, you know,
even
6 hours.
You know, when you do
drive
a car to Durban, you get tired.
Correct.
You know, I mean, they say stop every two hours, and these truck drivers sometimes get pushed hard.
Yeah. So I mean, I see it also as lane changing or lane keeping technology, and that's obviously alluding to your point, and then design that makes jackknifing impossible.
Yes, and why can it make jackknifing possible? Because, you know, and this is again down to those electric motors on those wheels. So the response time of an electric motor to change the torque on the wheel is infinitely faster than what a petrol kind of
diesel
prop shaft driven
yeah.
car could do. Plus, you can put a motor on every single wheel. Whereas with a traditional truck, you can only have the prop shaft driving the back wheels of the truck, not necessarily the front wheels. You can have four-wheel drive, but to drive them independently is something that the electric motor can do, which means that as soon as this truck starts jackknifing, the truck can put torque on the wheels to pull that thing straight again.
Well, I mean, that again, just going back to, you know, there's a massive problem. You know, a lot of fatalities and accidents out there because trucks jackknife. So let's change it and eliminate that as a risk factor.
As a risk factor, exactly. So, I mean, another phenomenal feature of this truck is its charging capabilities.
Yeah.
It can charge in 30 minutes. Now, you think 30 minutes is, and it needs a mega charger to charge,
yes,
a supercharger.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
You think that 30 minutes is long, but if you think about when a truck stops at a diesel stop,
yeah,
it takes at least 15 minutes to fill that truck because of the capacity of fuel.
Correct. Yeah. So I see that. Yeah, 400 miles in, well, a 400 mile charge in 30 minutes. I mean, that's absolutely spectacular. I see that they're going to do production of this truck in, well, 2019. And then just touching on that that Roadster, I don't know if you've, you know, obviously George is nodding his head here, so he knows about it already. But I see they want to have that out here, well, not out here, but out in 2020. And I mean, this car's absolutely blowing the lights out of all regular vehicles in terms of its speed, acceleration, all that kind of stuff. Do you want to touch on those numbers?
So you know, this new Roadster, from a Tesla point of view, you got to ask yourself a question: how much of it is hiding the woes of the Model 3? Because the hype around this sports car now,
yes,
is hiding the fact that that Tesla are actually battling to manufacture the volumes of the Model 3 that they said they were going to manufacture.
Correct.
So the timing of this Roadster, I think, has been chosen not to hide the manufacturing
but
woes,
just change focus.
But to change focus.
Exactly.
Likely. So I think that's what's going on here.
That's why I said he's a marketing genius. So
absolutely,
at his truck launch, he's not only, you know, launching his truck to truck drivers, but he's like, oh, and look what comes out of the truck, you know, and here's a Roadster. And everyone's like, oh, that's amazing. And to your point, taking your eyes off, and I don't think it was intentional from him not to be able to manufacture. They obviously still, a lot of the cars have been built by hand and it's not fully autonomous in terms of the factories, but the guy's really doing some great stuff.
So this car does 0 to 100 k's an hour, this Roadster,
yeah,
1.9 seconds.
So under 2 seconds.
And 0 to 160 in 4.2 seconds. Does the standing quarter mile in 8.8 seconds. Now, you don't get a supercar that does under 2 seconds.
Yeah.
Maybe some of the modified ones, like the jet cars,
yeah,
do under 2 seconds. You don't get cars that generally do under 2 seconds. You know, and for $200,000, 2.8 million rand, you got a car that's faster than any supercar on the planet.
Exactly. So it warrants that price tag, doesn't it?
Exactly.
And it's unfortunate that is the quickest hour of the week that is up again. And yeah, another fantastic show. You know, obviously there's a lot of, I'm really excited. I really, really am excited about next year. I think, and you know, and the years that are approaching, you know, quicker, 2019, 2020,
yeah,
because we're going to start seeing a lot more of this kind of stuff. And I really think it's fantastic. So if we can abide by the rules on the road and we can, you know, embrace, you know, electric vehicle technology, I think we're on a winning path.
I think it's an exciting time to be alive.
Fantastic, guys. Well, that's another show. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram at AutoTraderSA. And that's another show, Auto Central, over and out.
Cheers.
This is CliffCentral.com.